Rabbi Aaron Hirsch.
So I guess I have to start off by wishing a mazel tov to family Rose for their chasna this week, and for my son's wedding and marriage into that family. In this week's parasha, we find HaKadosh Baruch Hu warning Moshe and telling him to pass on this warning to Klal Yisrael. Vayom Hashem el Moshe leich el ha'om v'kidashtom hayom u'moch v'chibzu simloisam. And he adds, "V'igbalta esa'om saviv lemer." They need to be warned not to approach Har Sinai. And Moshe does so. Moshe carries out these instructions. Yet, in Pasuk Chof, "V'yered Hashem al Har Sinai al Reish Har v'yikra Hashem leMoshe al Reish Har v'yal Moshe." He calls Moshe back, having carried out the shlichus. He needs to carry out another. What is this second shlichus? Transpires, it's exactly the same as the first. Vayom Hashem el Moshe reid hoid ba'om, and tell them not to approach Har Sinai. And it is so identical to the original shlichus that Moshe almost protests and says, La yuchalom lalos el Har Sinai. Because you are Kadosh Baruch Hu atoy doisa bonu lemer hagbel es ha'or v'kidashtei. Nevertheless, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, carried out. And the Rishonim deal with the different questions that occurred. In other words, the different potential problems that could have manifested themselves were there not to have been adequate warnings not to approach Har Sinai. People could have confused what they saw, whether it was Moshe Rabbeinu that was involved with Matan Torah. And therefore, HaKadosh Baruch Hu needed to make it absolutely clear so that there should be no mistakes, because these mistakes could lead to disastrous consequences. People could confuse or conflate what had taken place at Matan Torah. And in order to prevent this happening, there needed to be this double warning. These mistakes are not unique, and these warnings are not unique in Torah, because there are other areas where similarly people are prone to coming to conclusions which are incorrect. And the Rambam, at the very end of Mishnah Torah, deals with Hilchus Melachim, laws that applies to Malchei Yisrael. At the very end of Hilchus Melachim, Perek Yud Aleph and Yud Beis, the Rambam deals with the last, Melech HaMashiach. And in the Frankel version of the Rambam, you have the uncensored elements, which have come to us through those Rambams that were printed in Muslim countries, because, as we will rapidly understand, the Christians didn't take too kindly to some of the inclusions in Perek Yud Aleph of Hilchus Melachim. And the Rambam tells us that Melech HaMashiach osid lamo yulahachzir Malchus Beis David liyoshna, and to build the Beis HaMikdash, to win wars, etc. And if he carries out stage one, so there's a chazoka that this person is Mashiach. And if he carries out stage two, and he brings all of Klal Yisrael, and he's machzalem Torah, mitzvahs, and builds the Beis HaMikdash, etc., then we know that this is Mashiach. In the standard Rambam, that's where it ends. But there is an addition in Halacha Dalet. The edition is the one that the Rambam actually wrote, but is censored in many versions. What happens v'im loy hitzliach? What happens if things did not actually work to plan? And this individual embarked on a journey, whether birushus or shalei birushus, and it gets derailed, either because they were clearly not the person for the job, or or for other reasons, then we should know that this is not what HaKadosh Baruch Hu promised. And then the Rambam goes on to write, Af Yeshu HaNoitzri, Shedimo Sheyeh Mashiach V'Nerag V'Bezdin. The Rambam tells us, you know, there have been pretenders to the throne, quite literally, and these people were Mashiachei Sheker, the most famous of which is Yeshu. And the Rambam himself, during his lifetime, had to deal with others who felt that they were royu to be Mashiach. The Rambam writes in a letter to a Rav in Marseille in France that there was an individual in Yemen who set himself up as being Mashiach, Jew. And at one stage, this came to the attention of the Sultan. And the Sultan had him brought into the royal court. And the Sultan said to him, so show me you are Mashiach. This is all in the letter that the Rambam is writing. And what then happened, and I paraphrase the Rambam, this aspiring individual said to the Sultan, you can cut off my head and I will live. So they did, and he didn't. And that was more or less the end of that Maisa. But there have been, throughout time, individuals who have set themselves up. Internally, the individual who caused the most destruction to Klal Yisrael was Shabtai Tzvi. In the 17th century, possibly as many as one-fifth of Klal Yisrael believed that this individual was Mashiach. And the negative outcomes of this Mashiach Sheker is something that Ad Hayom Hazeh we still live with, as will be explained, hopefully, as we go through it. However, in order to understand why Shabtai Tzvi was unfortunately as successful as he was, we need to understand the nature of successful revolutions. There are plenty of people who try and create change. The secular world, Yiddish Welt, all over. Most of them don't end up carrying out what they plan to do, because there need to be external factors in place. And those I am not responsible for. They either are there or not. Unfortunately, in the times of Shabtai Tzvi, there were a number of things that had occurred or that had been brewing over the last century that created almost the perfect conditions for Shabtai Tzvi to manifest. Firstly, there had been, throughout the couple of centuries leading up to that, Bifrat, the end of the 1400s, a series of expulsions from Western Europe to Eastern Europe. So the Ashkenazim had gone, they'd already left England in 1290 and France in 1391, but they had been gradually moved out of Western Europe into Central and Eastern Europe. And large-scale Golos seems to indicate Ikvus of the Mashiach. And that created its own life. For the Sephardim, the same was true as well. In Spain in 1492, in Portugal 1497, it wasn't quite the Golos, but it was nevertheless a tremendous gezera on the Yidden living in Portugal. And therefore, Yidden there moved not to Poland and Lithuania, but to Greece and Turkey, and there was a nascent small community in Eretz Yisrael as well. So all of this change, all of this movement, creates expectation. In addition, the 1500s was the era of the spread of Kabbalah. Now, we have to understand this in context. Kabbalah has clearly been around since time immemorial. The Svarim that we have, the seminal Svarim of Kabbalah, tell us, Sefer Yetzirah, the Zohar, these are Pirushim which go hand in hand with the rest of Torah Shebal Peh. But it had been taught from Rebbe to Talmud. The Ramban, who's one of the Amudei Kabbalah in terms of Masorah, was taught by two brothers in Girona, near Barcelona in Spain, and they were in turn taught by the Rivards and Rabbi Yitzchak Saginar in Provence, in the south of France. But it was individuals. We can trace the Masorah of Kabbalah from Rebbe to Talmud. It was in no way something that occurred in public. The 1500s changed this. Obviously, the Ari in Tzvas, there was the Shla a little bit later on, late 1500s, early 1600s, the Maral. But at this stage, there were already Bote Medrash that were learning and being taught Kabbalah. So it was more accessible. And I qualify that word more. It didn't mean you could go onto the Ota Chochma and print yourself off, whichever Sifrei Kabbalah you wanted. But at least there was the ability to access Kabbalah for a greater number than had been the case until now. Until now it had literally been the select few. Now there were larger numbers. And Shabtai Tzvi was one of those. He was taught Kabbalah at a very young age. He was in his teens. So that was another factor that created the ability to do things and to talk about things, discuss matters which had been off limits. Possibly the Makkah B'Patish to all that was going on was the Khmelnytsky massacres of 1648-1649, Tach V'Tat, which destroyed Kehillos in the Ukraine and in eastern Poland to such a degree that once again there was an expectation that this was Ikfas of the Mashiacha and that something much greater was going to happen in the very near future. Now, the important thing to understand in terms of Shabtai Tzvi, who made the claim to being Mashiach, is that normally in a revolution, you have come to overturn that which exists. People have been going in this direction, and you now tell them, no, you're wrong, we need to do an about turn, 180 degrees, and go in the opposite direction. What Shabtai Tzvi was trying to teach people is that which you believe in, I am part of. They believed in Moshiach. They believed he would come. He did not come to change people's mind, but to fulfill the emunah which they had been thinking, if not actually verbalizing, on a daily basis. And you can now start thinking about how badly Klal Yisrael must have been affected in the aftermath. Because believing in Shabtai Tzvi was not a defection from Yiddishkeit, but a fulfillment of Yiddishkeit. And here they are doing what they're supposed to be doing, only to be bitterly disappointed. Now what? Where does that leave me as a Ma'amin? If I believe in what I'm supposed to believe, I can now be led in the completely wrong direction. So what am I supposed to believe in? You can already realize that there must have been longer term effects to this, shockwaves that affected Klal Yisrael even after Shabtai Tzvi's death, because they'd been doing what they're supposed to be doing. Shabtai Tzvi himself, it is difficult to know where he was at. What was he thinking? Did he actually believe? Did he subsequently believe when he was talked into it? The accounts that we have, and by the way, the accounts are not just from Yidden, Goyim, people in prominent positions across the world wrote about the phenomenon of Shabtai Tzvi, because it affected Europe for sure, and even the Jews in North Africa, and therefore the Goyim. This was a mass movement. This wasn't something that was localized to one particular town or even one particular country. It spread across Europe. And therefore, non-Jews were writing about the effects of Shabtai Tzvi as they were taking place. So where he was at is actually difficult to know. And if not for the fact that there were people in his life who were able to accelerate his claims to being Mashiach, once again, it's possible that it would have died an early death. But unfortunately, internal factors were also in place, as well as the external factors which we've described. Let's talk a little bit about dates, places and times. Shabtai Tzvi was born in 1626. It is said that he was born on Tisha B'Av, and in fact his followers, even after he died, made Sudas on Tisha B'Av, because this was the day that Mashiach was born, whatever the outcome was. By the age of 18, he was given what we would call smicha. It was a bechina and a toyar that was much more than simply learning chelik aleph of Yeridea. He was considered a chacham. And, as I said earlier, not only in terms of nigla, but also in terms of nista. He was living in Izmir, a port town in Turkey, and he was the middle of three boys. His father did business with the English. Izmir was a trading port, bringing in goods from the Far East and shipping them into Western Europe. And the Jews had quite a hand in the trade that was going on. And Shabtai Tzvi's father was no exception to this. The Jews there generally spoke more than one language, which was very helpful. You could translate, you could keep things running smoothly. And he was quite wealthy. And therefore he was able to do something that most were not able. And that is keep at least one of his sons in learning beyond the age of Bar Mitzvah. If we go back, not to the 1600s, but even the 1700s, the 1800s, the vast majority of Yidden did not have the opportunity to learn beyond the age of Bar Mitzvah. This doesn't mean they never learnt Torah beyond then, but in any formal way, and in any way that took up a majority of the day, it was an impossibility. It was an economic impossibility. Most people had to work. And therefore, it was the rare exception, the few remaining percent that were privileged to be able to learn into their later teens and those few that carried on even beyond then. Shabtai Tzvi was one of them because his father could afford it. He was a very different type of individual. Firstly, because he had, they would call in Ivrit today, a safa mashutefet, he had a common wavelength with the Hamoin Am. Back in those days, the role of the rabbi was not, as it is today, hatch, match and dispatch. The Rav had nothing to do, almost, with pastoral care. Those weren't their chiyuvim, those weren't their duties. What the Rav did was paskan shailas, all types of shailas, especially because in those days communication was in its infancy, and if you didn't have the answer, who would? How am I supposed to get the answer? It's on your shoulders. So that was the main job of the Rav. The Rav would also teach those few individuals who, as we mentioned, were privileged enough to be able to sit and learn. How many? Depends on how big the Rav was and how big the town was. 5, 50, depended. There was no formal curriculum. That was only in the 1800s, in the times of Ruchaim Volozhin. That was one of the changes that took place then. But the Rav would teach to the best of the Rav's ability and to the best of the Talmidim's ability, when those two happily coincided. And if not, then not. And the Rav would speak twice a year. Shabbos Adodl, Shabbos Shuvah. There are those who hark back to those days. And the Rav's interaction with the Kehillah was limited to those people who sought out the Rav for his Torah. But the Hamoinam would see the Rav from a distance, would give cover to the Rav, but would not necessarily have any Sprach with him. Shabtai Tzvi was very different. He spoke the language of the common person. He was a Bal Menagin, both in terms of singing and making up songs. And he was helped in this by having a condition which had not been diagnosed in the 17th century, but in the 19th century would be labelled as manic depressive. Which means as follows. He was able to hold court for 24 hours straight, carry on talking, giving shiurim, singing, saying tehillim. There are records of people who literally watched him all night long saying tehillim. And we have to realise we're talking about a person who had a magnetic personality and a person whose presence was inspiring. And people were taken in just by that alone, even if they didn't learn anything from that individual. Just being in his Dalai Lama's. And therefore he could go for hours straight. Very unusual individual. That was when he was in his manic phase. Could keep on going for hours. And then he would fall into depression. For a day, for a week, for a month. And it would be explained away that he's in his hispoidetus. He's now in solitary, he needs to reflect, needs to talk to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, whatever it is. So there were very good reasons that were given for his behaviour. But his behaviour was unusual. Now sometimes unusual is on the wrong side of the fence. But initially when meeting Shabtai Tzvi, this unusual would appear as something which is great. Something which means that this person has an ability which the ordinary person does not. Now, he was already teaching a small circle of people. And one of the things that he was doing, being that he was somewhat, or actually to a degree, well-versed in Kabbalah, he was pronouncing Shem Hashem, the Yudke Vovke, as it is written. Now, nowadays, if we want to know if that's right or wrong, once again, we go back to the Eitz HaChokhmah, and here it will serve the perfect task of telling us whether it's Muta or Asa. But in those days, since most of the Rabbonim were not acquainted with Kabbalah, it was not the type of Torah that was being taught. So they are not sure if this is something which is totally Asa, or which is for Yechidei Skula. And therefore, you label him as unusual, and you don't quite know what to do with him. Even the Rabbonim of the city. He also nearly drowned at the age of 20, living in a port town, and he was rescued, so to speak, at the last minute. And this was seen, and it would be translated in later days, as somebody who basically came back to life. This is Yitzchok on the Akedah. Now we can sort of, you know, dismiss all of these things and laugh them away. But if you're living in the moment, it doesn't work that easily. Hindsight is a wonderful gift for writing history. But it's not so wonderful for making up your mind as to what you're supposed to do in the here and now. And therefore all of these things are so unusual, are so different, that people, even Rabbonim, don't exactly know which way to turn. He got married, and he never consummated the marriage. And at this stage, the Rabbonim in Shtot said, forget it. Either you go through with the wedding, or with the proper marriage, or you divorce her. So there had been kiddushin, clearly, and no nisuin. And he decided to divorce her. And once again, this was seen as being somebody who's a kaddish. Somebody who is divorced from all tanuge olam hazeh. Hagam in Yiddishkeit, we don't believe in that. But if you're into Kabbalah, maybe that's what you're supposed to be doing. Eventually there had been too much of this behaviour, and he was expelled from town. And he starts his 7-year golus in the area, and he then comes as a result into contact with far more Yidden than would have ever been the case for the normal Rav. A Rav could have been born, brought up and died within 50 square miles. Never left that district. Here, Shabtai Tzvi is now wandering through Turkey and Greece. He ends up in Salonika. Salonika was a very unusual city. For one reason, and that is two-thirds of the city was Jewish at his time. The only city in the Sephardi world where the majority were Jews. And once again, he makes a very powerful effect when he turns up. The Rabbonim in town don't know what to do with him, but he becomes a Shem Dover. He is known by the Hamoin Am. How many others, how many Gedolim in Poland would the Jews in Salonika have been aware of? Shabtai Tzvi has this effect and now has this following. Eventually, same story as with Izmir, he's expelled and he ends up in Yerushalayim. Ends up in Eretz Yisrael. And he is being taught there by Rav Yaakov Chagiz, who initially sees Shabtai Tzvi as a Talmud worthy of being taught Kabbalah. One of the other people in that circle, although younger, was Nosson Ha'azoti, who is known to us as Nathan of Gaza. He will have an enormous effect on Shabtai Tzvi's life. Because at one stage, and once again, we are not sure of the exact details, but at one stage, he will convince Shabtai Tzvi that Shabtai Tzvi is Mashiach, and that he, Nathan of Gaza, the Gaza Strip caused problems even back then, that he was Eliyahu Hanavi, and that he was the one who was the Mevaser. And what Nathan of Gaza embarked upon is what we would call in 21st century terminology a PR campaign. If you want to be a successful Mashiach with all the other factors that we've described, the last that you need is a good publicist. Yeshu Lahavdil had Paul, and Shabtai Tzvi had Nathan of Gaza. And he writes letters all over Europe and tells Kehillos that this individual is Mashiach, and he appends signatures of Rabbonim, which were either true or false. But let's say that the signatures were false. You're a Rav in Amsterdam. You get this letter, which has a slew of signatures on it. And now what? You're going to try perhaps and find out whether this is true. Everybody in Stadt is aware of the letter. All your Kehillah is aware of the letter. And you now want to find out if the contents are actually correct or not. You have to write back, or you have to write to other people who are in the area. It'll take months. Till you find out the truth. Everybody in town is already nidluck. They're already on fire with the fact that Moshiach is here. And unlike us today, in those days, they really did want Moshiach to arrive, even if only for very basic reasons. They were living in a golus, which they wanted out from. They were living a very, very difficult existence. And if this means that we are essentially free, we buy into this. So the Hamoin Am believed in Shabtai Tzvi. And in a very short space of time, this is taking place basically in 1665, in a very short space of time, there are thousands and thousands of Yidden all over Europe who are maminim, so to speak, in the fact that Shabtai Tzvi is Mashiach. And I repeat, remember that what they are believing is something which is one of the Yud Gimel Ikarim. They are not becoming apikorsim, faket. It's that which is in the siddur. That's what they believe in. That's part of the problem. And we have descriptions from shuls in Italy, in Holland, where Yidden were fasting every Monday and Thursday, giving all of their money away to tzedakah. I mean, why not? Mashiach is about to arrive. Don't you want to do those last few mitzvahs that will tip the balance? We're not talking about a conceptual arrival of Mashiach, but an actual arrival. He's here. We just need to make it happen. Wouldn't you renounce everything? People were not engaged in business anymore. They were sitting and learning in the Beis HaMedrash. Once again, start thinking about what's going to happen when the bubble bursts, when it's not Moshiach. What's going to happen to these people, to their emunah, and to their economic life? All of these things are going to be after effects of Shabbatai Tzvi. But in as it was happening then, and we have the shamosim of shuls in Europe recording these events. Many of these books were lost in the Holocaust, unfortunately, but there are some that survived, and we are being told what was taking place in these cities. Amazingly, if we turn to England for a moment. So in 1665 and 1666, if we were to talk about London, it's a little place down south from here. In 1665, there was the plague. In 1666, there was what was called the Great Fire of London. Who was writing history at the time? Samuel Pepys, right? 12 volumes of a diary. How many Yidden lived in England at the time? Kmat none. They've just been allowed back in, 1654 basically, just been allowed back in. Are there 1,000 Jews in the whole of England? Ulai v'ulai. And there are millions going there. So what's the chances that Samuel Pepys actually knows a Jew? Yeah, maybe, maybe. He writes in his diary that he knows for sure that the Jews of London will offer him odds of 10 to 1. If he gives them a pound, they'll give him back 10 pounds. That a certain Jew in Izmir, in Smyrna, in Turkey, is the Messiah. Which means 2,000 miles away from where Shabbatai Tzvi was, Goyim, who had kmat no connection or knowledge of Jews, were already aware of Shabbatai Tzvi.
Shows what you can do without the internet.
Shows what you can do if you have good PR, yes. True or untrue, PR apparently works. And therefore, this swept the Jewish world. The East India Dock Company, which was based in Holland but had major offices in Germany, reports that in 1666 they couldn't hire any ships from Germany, because the Yidden had hired them all. They'd sold up their houses, whatever they had, for a pittance, and they were going to Eretz Yisrael. They were going to move to Eretz Yisrael. Moshiach's here. What would the Rabbonim do? So the Rabbonim were split into four categories. There were Rabbonim who simply had no idea. How am I supposed to know what is going on, never mind how to pasken, events that are taking place 1,500 miles away. I can't tell you. There were Rabbonim who believed. And why not? They're getting reports signed by other Rabbonim, people who seem to know what's going on. They believed. And therefore they went along with it. And there's no taina on them. Then there were Rabbonim who were wary and said, I don't know if it is or it isn't, but there's a wave of tshuva going on in Klal Yisrael, and therefore it's worth riding this wave. And that was a mistake. Because if you're riding a wave of tshuva based on a false premise, then you're going to have to deal with the outcome when things fall apart. And then there was a fourth category of Rabbonim, who actively opposed Shabbatai Tzvi. Most famous was Rabbi Yaakov Sasportas. He's originally from North Africa. He was a Rav in Hamburg, a Rav in Amsterdam. And in gratitude for his opposition to Shabbatai Tzvi, his kehillah threw him out. Because he is delaying Raglei Moshiach. Because of him, Moshiach might not come. Because of this, he calls himself a rabbi, he's an apikoros. And he ended up in England. Which is why there is a painting of him in the National Gallery. Because he was here for a short while. And he had to deal with the fallout afterwards. Besides the fact that the Sefer he wrote about Shabbatai Tzvi, in his Shalos Tshuvos, one of the questions that was asked from the Yeshivas Kesater in Amsterdam, they had brought in saying Birkas Kohanim again. Birkas Kohanim Be'etzem is a mitzvah saseh, which applies every day, Chutz La'aretz Eretz Yisrael, everywhere. But we don't say Birkas Kohanim for whatever reason. There they started saying it. Because sheikhs around, we want to chapin as many mitzvahs as possible. And they then wrote to Rabbi Yaakov Sasportas saying, we've done this three times, now what? It's a mitzvah saseh d'oraisa. So he said it was based on something that was sheker. Don't have to carry it out. But this is what was going on in the Jewish world. Eventually, this comes to the attention of the Sultan. The Sultan of Turkey, the head of the Ottoman Empire, of course, it's going to be in his territory that Shabtai Tzvi is now going to make his claim to the throne. So he first has him arrested and placed under house arrest in Adrianople. But there's still people who are able to see him. The Taz from Poland sends his son-in-law. The son-in-law comes back impressed and tells the Taz all about it. And he says that at one stage Shabtai Tzvi went out into the fields and people had complained to him about a certain landowner, a goy, who was oppressing the Jews. And Shabtai Tzvi said, you know, I'm going to pull up the grass and this person's going to die. And apparently kach hava. And the Taz dismissed that out of hand. It says in Tehillim, Behevel Piv Yehorig Ish, the chef is able to do this without having to do a Maisa. Maisa is a level of practical Kabbalah or Kishuv, and therefore, you know, he's not the real deal. But you have to be the Taz to know that. For the rest of the people, that was a pretty impressive show. Eventually, Shabtai Tzvi is brought in 1666 before the Islamic Council in Constantinople, in Istanbul. And he is given a choice. The Sultan was there, but behind a screen, the various members of the Turkish government were there, and they gave Shabtai Tzvi a choice. You either accept Islam, or we kill you. And Shabtai Tzvi accepted Islam in September of 1666. And you would have thought that would bring the movement to an end. It didn't. And for this, and I'm aware we're running out of time, to deal slightly with one of the central ideas of Kabbalah, of being male nitzotzos, of being able to go into the depths in order to bring out the Kedusha. The idea that Shlomo married Bas Parai, in order to bring Shlemus, not just to Klal Yisrael with the building of the Beis HaMikdash, but to the whole world. This is what his followers claimed was happening when he became a Muslim. He was bringing the whole of the Muslim world, which was the most powerful empire at the time, with him. Umola Oretz Deah. That's what he was doing. He was being Mesa Nefesh for us. And, of course, Nathan of Gaza, his Novi, quote-unquote, was still at large and was still travelling places. He was in Venice, he was in Rome, and it didn't matter what the Rabbonim were doing, this belief system was still there. Of course, for many, there was disappointment. But for others, they still believed. And eventually, Shabtai Tzvi dies. He dies Yom Kippur, 1676, probably in Albania, not quite sure. But Nathan of Gaza was still around till 1680. He died in Skopje, in what is today Macedonia, and his kaver was still one that people went to for hundreds of years afterwards. It's not there anymore, but they went there for hundreds of years afterwards. In fact, Shabtai Tzvi's house, up till the 1990s, there were people who would go there and daven in his house. Because there were people who were maminim in Shabtai Tzvi up until this very day. They're called the Donme. There was a whole group in Salonika who ended up moving to Turkey after the 1919-1921 Turkish Wars. There was a population exchange. They were moved to Turkey. They carried on believing in Shabtai Tzvi. And there were three different groups. One of them were radicals. All the Chiyuvei Krisus became mitzvahs. So they deliberately did all of the Averus in you see in Masechtas Krisus. But there were people who continued believing in him, until definitely in numbers until between the wars, but even Ad Hayom Hazeh. And there was a Bissach Forest in Salonika, on the outskirts of Salonika, where these followers would be buried. But briefly, to talk about the perhaps longer term. Firstly, the persecution of the Ramchal in the next century, not long after, Ramchal was born in 1707, happened because Klal Yisrael did not want to make this mistake again. An unmarried individual who's teaching Kabbalah, it had all of the same factors to it, and Klal Yisrael were too scared, the Rabbonim were too scared that this was history repeating itself within 50 years. That's why more than 50% of the Ramchal's writings were lost, were burnt, confiscated, completely lost. The Ramchal. But they couldn't risk it. The longer term effects were those Yidden generally in Western Europe, who said, clearly, even if you're a Ma'amin, that's not good enough. You need to find out your information not just from within the Torah, but from the outside. And it created the seeds of reform. And in the East, there were those that said, Golus is going to be long and bitter and we don't know when it's going to end. We need to turn inwardly. We need to find simcha inwardly. We need to find meaning inwardly. And it created the seeds of Hasidus. And therefore, many of the major movements that took place in the 1700s, in the aftermath, in the shadow of Shabtai Tzvi, happened not solely, but were given a strong impetus because of Shabtai Tzvi. And it was what you might call an existential crisis. Klal Yisrael did not know where to go. They would then be battered by the Rabbi Yonason Eibershitz and Rabbi Yaakov Emden, and also by the Ramchal. So there were effects happening in Klal Yisrael which took them on a journey which was not an easy one. But we have to be aware that one individual with the ability and the times in which he lived, unfortunately, created an effect that really tested the emunah and the ability of Klal Yisrael to hold on, even when the questions were great and the answers did not seem to be that apparent.
Oh, really?
Problem is, Cameron couldn't do the ring.
Right.
So he took it this morning to Steve.
Steve is in Stockholm.